Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. What the world needs today is more empathy, faith, and the belief that one person's compassion can change thousands of lives. Kathy Booth is one such person. Founder of Umaja Orphanage Kenya, she grew up in Charleville, a small Western Queensland town known for sheep, cattle, and community spirit. Her father was a shearer who spent long stretches away, leaving her mother to raise four children on a modest income, all while working in the local department store. Though poor by Australian standards, Kathy remembers her childhood fondly. Those early years shaped her sense of empathy and the values she carries today: compassion, resilience, and a quiet determination to help others. Her maternal instinct and unshakable compassion became the foundation for Umaja Orphanage Kenya, a home that has given children not just shelter and education, but love, belonging, and a future. Hello, Kathy. I'm so grateful that you've agreed to share your story with me today. How did your childhood experience help you develop such deep empathy for others?
My dad, he was always about giving others who had less than us, helping them out. So we had our vegetable garden. So our outing basically of a Sunday when Dad was home would be to go over to the sand hills opposite on the Warrego River and give vegetables to those less fortunate, which were mainly Aboriginal and Aboriginal descent. So Dad always said that if we've got surplus, we need to help other people. Dad was always one who was always there to help anybody. And this might sound a little bit crude, and you can edit it out if you want. Dad was always known as the man who would give his ass away and shit through his liver. That was my dad. He never said a bad word against anybody. My mother was the same, because she grew up in a very poor environment as well as my father. Both of them didn't finish school in primary school. My father was working as on a drover's team when he was 11 years old. So resilience was a big thing in my family growing up, and helping others.
How was that the catalyst for, you know, what your early childhood taught you about life?
That we should always help those less fortunate than ourselves. Don't always put ourselves first. You know, have time for ourselves, but there's always somebody worse off than you that may need a little hand up at some point in time. And another thing they taught me, that you never know what lies beneath somebody. You might see the tip of the iceberg, but you don't know what troubles they've got that they're internalizing at a particular moment. And to always give compliments to people, you know, even passing in the street, stop and talk to them, because you never know what they're going through.
Oh, that's such a beautiful lesson to have to carry through life, is to give each other, you know, give people time and courtesy, because like you say, you don't know what other people are going through. What sort of aspirations did you have for your own life growing up?
Because we were poor, they couldn't afford to. I wanted to be a teacher, but my parents couldn't naturally afford to send me past grade 9. So I always wanted to aspire to be a teacher. And funnily enough, my mother reminded me of this. We used to live on a gully in Charleville. We backed onto a gully, and over the other side of the gully was what I thought was an orphanage. And it wasn't an orphanage, Mum told me all those years later, and I'd go over and spend afternoons playing with all the kids there. It was a boarding house for people on cattle stations, kids on cattle stations and sheep stations, who used to come in and board there to go to school. But for somehow, I always thought it was an orphanage. Maybe Mum had said that's an orphanage, I don't know. Mum said, I always said to her, I want to run one of these places when I'm older. when I grow up. And life takes different turns. I didn't remember that till years later. And when I was able to finance myself to become a teacher, I did. And so I was the first one in the family ever to have gone to university. But that was my calling, to always work with children and show them kindness, because you never know what their home lives are like. I always brought home stray dogs and stray children, which my father always reminded me of.
We have that in common, Kathy, and particularly injured animals and wildlife. I was constantly bringing things home to my parents as well.
Yes, all of the above. And I ended up being a wildlife carer when my children were young as well. So that was something I always did. If any children didn't have food for lunch or were wandering the streets on the way home from school, I'd bring them home and they'd always be welcome. Didn't matter, you know, whether they were Greek, whether they were Italian, whether they were Aboriginal, Mum always had food for them in the afternoon after school. So, and dogs, stray cats, you name them.
Your parents sound wonderful, and obviously, even though you were underprivileged, as I might put it, because you definitely weren't poor by my standards of, you know, what we look at as successful in creating human beings on this planet, you were very wealthy. You had a rich culture in your family. What did your parents teach you about a work ethic?
Oh, my goodness me. That you never took a day off work. Even if you were sick, you turned up. Your responsibility was to your employer. Your employer paid your wages, and you must always respect, never question the employer. You're there to do a job and you're going to get paid. That was their work ethic. I instilled that into my own children. But nowadays, having become a teacher, I know that you can question things, whereas I was taught you never question anything. You respect your elders. You respect those people that employ you. Well, nowadays it's a lot different. You still have that respect, but you also have, you know, you can use your voice to question things, whereas we were never taught that part of it. You know, that was the era of the 50s and 60s. Dad was a shearer, and then he became a shearer's cook. And then in my teenage years, he couldn't shear anymore because of his back. He was a gun shearer out in Charlie. I think his record was 255 sheep in one day back then. Then he became, he got a job in the local Greek cafe, and that's where he stayed till he wasn't able to work anymore. Mum, as I said, she worked in a local department store and also in a chemist.
How many brothers and sisters did you have, Kathy?
I have an older sister, 2 years older than me. Then there's me. Then there's 10 years between myself and my brother, and 10 months. Mind you, 10 months between my brother and my youngest sister. There was four of us.
I'm not sure I've heard of someone being born that close to their sibling. 10 months isn't much turnaround.
Raised a lot of eyebrows in the small town of Charleville, I can tell you.
I can imagine, but that's the way biology goes, I suppose. So, Kathy, what type of career did you settle on, seeing as you couldn't become a teacher through university?
Oh, I started off, I left Charleville when I was 17, and I went and worked in Perth in a supermarket, and then I went to Bundaberg and I worked in a chemist in a service station, and then I was married, I went and lived in Papua New Guinea. My husband got work there, so we went and lived in Papua New Guinea for around seven plus years, and that's where I first saw real poverty. That's when I saw, you know, boy, how lucky are we? But then they had a lot of water, which Kenya doesn't have. So that I think that was something that really opened my eyes. And I loved the simple life over there. I would never have come back to Australia if I had a choice.
Wow. What was so special about your time in Papua New Guinea?
We lived on an island called North Solomon's Province, otherwise known as Bougainville Island, and we didn't have TV. The ship only come in once every 6 weeks. To me, it was an idyllic lifestyle to bring up children in a tropical paradise, just the very simple life.
given your background and your experience of, you know, such a dry continent and especially noticeable in Western Queensland in areas like Charleville, what sort of challenges have you faced that have made you as resilient as you are to open an orphanage in Kenya?
Well, lots of things. I don't share a lot of what lies beneath me, but yes, a lot of trauma. My son developed schizophrenia when he was 18, and that was a long, long process of in and out of hospitals and getting him well. Thankfully, he's doing fantastic, full-time job for years and years and years, but that was really heartbreaking. A lot of other things that I prefer not to talk about made me exceptionally resilient. You just have to be really, really strong no matter what, even though you don't want to be. Yeah, I think a lot of things shape you in your life. I also have a very determined personality. And my father always said to me, I'm so stubborn and I'm so determined that I need to put it to good use when I grow up. Because if I make a decision about something, it's come with me or stand out of my way. That's just my personality.
I can hear that in your voice, your strength of character and determination. And having looked at your story online on your website, I just have such esteem for people like you who dedicate their life to others. And I'm wondering how you found yourself in Kenya.
I went on a round the world holiday with my sister and her husband. And we'd planned, we always wanted to do an African safari. So our last two places were, three places were Egypt, Rwanda and Kenya. So we'd done Rwanda, which I absolutely fell in love with. And thankfully I've been able to go back two more times and, you know, saw the poverty there. But when I got to Kenya, it was just a sense of, I suppose, being overwhelmed at so many children in dumps and, you know, walking around the street. Now, this is going back in 2010, and I got our safari driver to take us to different schools and things, being a teacher and donating things to the schools and different villages. And then I decided I would go back and volunteer as a teacher in a school. And that's where it happened. Never thinking that I would do anything like I was going to do. I was just going back to volunteer to give back, you know. And then I went back two more times and volunteered. I took long service from my teaching career, or added long service weeks onto my annual holidays or, you know, school holidays, and would go back. So I volunteered in two different orphanages, twice in one and then once in another one, and just saw the overwhelming need at that point in time, and that I could probably do something about it. So I didn't make up my mind after volunteering in the orphanages. I'd come home and it was actually my birthday and I was making myself a cup of coffee and I just thought, I have to do something. I'm going to do it. And if I fail, I fail. Whatever. I had the passion to start it. So I thought, I'm going to start my own charity. Don't know how I'm going to do it. So I went to a lawyer. Because I thought, I didn't know how to start a charity. I went to a lawyer and asked him, and he said, I'm better off Googling it, because he really didn't know, because it wasn't up their alley. And strangely enough, that same lawyer back in beginning of 2011, he came on a volunteer team with me in June this year, and we realised he was the lawyer that I first went to. We went as a team, so there was a lot of people coming, but when we all had our initial meetings, he realized that I was the one, and I didn't recognize him because he had no hair now. So
people change. Yeah. You mentioned the difference between Papua New Guinea and Kenya was water. How challenging has it been to set up an orphanage, even with the basics?
Oh, I can't even begin to tell you. I was very fortunate to meet some very honest Kenyan people in the beginning, and they've been with me right through to this day. Very difficult. Look, when I bought the land, you were able to buy land as a foreigner, but now you can't. It changed not long after that. And to make sure that you had the title deeds and not fake ones, there was just so much to get through at the beginning. So there was quite a few trips in my mind before I actually did anything. And then going and getting approval from the Kenrin, the children's department, that I could actually start. It was overwhelming, but I did have the guidance of local Kenyans, and also one of the orphanage owners that I volunteered at. They were like my mentor to help me not make the same mistakes they did. They're an Irish couple. So they were tremendously important on my journey, because I'd always check, is this the right price for fencing? Is this, you know, where I should be doing, what I should be doing? And they were always a guiding light for me in those initial stages. And yes, I've made mistakes. We all make mistakes. I don't call them mistakes, really. Learning experiences, because you're dealing in a totally different social system full of corruption. Navigating that is difficult in itself. And then also just how different our countries are in work ethics and different things like that, yeah.
Even culture. How much have you learned about Kenyan culture in Africa in particular?
Oh, I'm still learning. In the beginning, it was similar to Papua New Guinea culture in it reminded me of similarities. Like, if we want a job done in Australia, you know, it's set to a certain standard. But in Kenya, from what I've found, this is my own personal experience, if the job's done, it's done. And still to this day, it's the same thing. But that's not the people's fault. It's what they've been taught. Culture's very, I actually am saddened at times that we don't have such a rich culture in Australia, and sense of belonging and family and, you know, the traditions. I really respect a lot of the traditions in Kenya, and I wish we had them, you know, caring for each other, caring for our elders, caring for other members of the family who don't have anything, and sharing. And it's called harambe, in that if somebody doesn't have any food, then it's your responsibility as a family to assist them. And because there's no social security there, if they didn't get assistance from family and other members of the community, people would die. It's not like, you know, there's the dole like we have here. There's nothing.
Earlier you mentioned you had developed a lot of resilience through an experience with your son and his diagnosis with schizophrenia. Some of the injuries and some of the medical issues I saw in those hospitals when we travelled to Zambia, you know, it just made me so sad. So how do you think your life experience has enabled you to carry on through the emotional toll?
I think it wasn't only my son's illness. It was my husband worked away. He was in mining, so he worked away for 25 years. So I raised the four children on my own, basically, because he would be gone for 2 months and home for 2 weeks. So I basically raised the four kids. It was like deja vu, mum doing it with us, and I did it with my children. And I also was working as a full-time teacher aide and doing university at the same time as all of this was going on. So I don't know whether I just decompartmentalize things and think I'll deal with them later. I have to keep going. I have to keep doing this. So that's probably what happens. But dealing with some of the issues that I have with the children we have and the trauma, absolute trauma they've been through, is for me to be there as their mother and let them know that no matter what's happened to them, there is somebody who loves them and that cares for them. And that now that the children are getting older, some of the long-term ones, our eldest is 18, he describes it as, I suppose, my coming into his life is that I was like an angel that rescued him basically from death. So, you know, when the children are able to verbalize, it's just love and support. I think just not giving up on getting like my son better. That was always my goal. I was going to get him better no matter what. And with other issues, you know, with my other children and their health issues too. is that we were just going to get through it the best that we could, and we don't give up.
There's an image on your website of you holding a child, and you can see how much love and dedication you have. How do you expect to grow? You know, what's the next step for you in this orphanage?
It's 15 acres, so we farm a lot of it. The children's homes are in a separate compound. There's two children's homes, a boy's and a girl's. I really don't want to grow too much more. Some of the orphanages that I've seen, they might have 150 children. You know, I did my due diligence, by the way, before I went into this. I went to Tanzania. I went around different orphanages in Kenya to see what was best practice, what I liked and what I didn't like, and how I would set the children's homes up, because I wanted all the infrastructure there before I took in any children. I'd seen too many fail by people coming, you know, like myself, coming to Kenya and just renting a house and putting children in there. No, I wasn't going to do that. And I didn't want dormitory style. I wanted family homes. And that's what I made happen. So in some children's homes, to answer your question, when you've got 150 children, it is really hard to know each and every one of those children and their needs and their personalities. So I didn't want it too big, and I still don't want it too big. I just want to have children to be able to know that I know all about their quirks and their mannerisms and their lives, and that it is still like family homes, a small family village. And that's how I want it to be. I did intend to actually start a school there, but knowing the red tape, knowing what you have to go through with the Kenyan government, I'm not going down that road.
We actually visited an orphanage in Kabwe in Zambia when we were there, and you can see just how dedicated the people there are, but also how grateful those children are for the opportunity they've been given. How can people support you in this quest?
By donating, whether a monthly donation would be fantastic, because then I don't have to worry about where is the money coming from for the next month's wages. Either supporting one of our children, sponsoring one of our children, because medical costs are very expensive, school fees, clothing. We grow a lot of our food, but we can't grow everything. One-off donations, money is what we need to keep it running. And I take volunteers over to the project in two teams every year. And I've taken over, I think from the last group, I think we're up to about 240 Australians have come and volunteered at the project. The wonderful thing there, Kim, is that the volunteers then go away and share the story, which brings more interest and more volunteers and more people wanting to help in some way, which is greatly beneficial. And people can look on our Facebook page, our website, see the work that we do. You know, I often get asked, why didn't I help people in Australia? And I always ask them, well, what are you doing to help? And also what the reason is, there is no social security there, and we're all part of this one big world. Why aren't we all doing a little bit for each other? Because nobody ever went broke by helping somebody else or giving a little. So that's my basic answer, and sharing the story. I've spoken in a lot of schools. I do a lot of guest speaking around the country via Zoom or in person when I go on the road for 2 or 3 weeks to different clubs and places like that. I like to share the story because you can hear about it, but once you see and hear about some of the things and the challenges, you know, I always talk about the good, the bad and the ugly, because there's a lot of ugly dealing with Kenyan government.
I noticed Hamisi's on your website, and you're sharing the story of his, like, speaking of medical bills, you're sharing the story of his recovery. How did you receive him?
We receive all our children through the children's department, only through the children's department. And Hamisi was brought to our attention by one of the officers in the children's department, in that he was chronically neglected by his mother. So his mother, she did have a husband, and Hamisi was born, and then the husband left her. So she was a single mother. And as a lot of ladies in Kenya, there's nobody to support them. So they need another man to support them. And that the second man did not want him at all because he was so malnourished. And as it turned out, he is an epileptic. So she would just leave him for days in the mud hut. And it was the grandfather who went to the children's department to complain about what his daughter was doing. So this had been going on for quite some time, and then we were allocated him. So the day he came to us, he was 5 years old. He weighed 5 kilos. 5 kilos. That's all he weighed. And when we got him and we took him to the hospital, they didn't think he'd live the night. But now, 18 months later, we're still trying to get him walk. He's a completely different little boy. He's had 2 operations and we will get him walking. He's got mild cerebral palsy and he's one of our success stories. We did have another little girl who we rehomed. She was our most chronically neglected girl. Her name was Zulfa. But we managed just at the beginning of COVID to find an aunt who took her, which was wonderful. We are able to manage to get some children rehomed with family or villages from where they come from. We do take in also not only orphans, chronically neglected, single, double orphans, we take in rape victims, children rape victims. So they might be with us for a week, 6 months till their court cases are finished, or a night as well as, and that's pretty heartbreaking. Lots of counselling with those children.
Kathy Booth, I am totally in your debt for what you're doing. And if I can encourage others to support you, and when I'm able to support you, I'd be more than happy to. In fact, I'd love to go back to Africa and visit Kenya with you one day as a volunteer. Thank you so much for sharing these stories. It really matters.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Founder of Umaja Orphanage Kenya, Kathy Booth, whose journey reminds us that compassion often begins in the humblest of places, in the lessons of a small town childhood, in watching parents quietly give what little they had, and in the courage to act on a dream that never faded. Through Umaja Orphanage Kenya, Kathy has shown what's possible when hope meets purpose. Each child she's helped represents a ripple of kindness, proof that even the hardest paths can lead to extraordinary compassion. You'll find all the links and ways to support Kathy's mission in the show notes. Because when we rise from our challenges, we find the strength to lift others. And in doing so, we teach our children that love, empathy, and hope are the most powerful gifts we can give. Find more information about my work as an author and coach on my website, kimclyden.com. All those details are also in the show notes. Join me next week for another inspiring story that shows us how we can be the change we want to see in the world.